Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and my guest this week is Lindsay Borgon. Lindsay is a writer, a researcher, an oral historian, and I love this. She says she was the 2018 National Geographic Explorer. That's a conversation for another time, but I would love to know what you got to do. Lindsay's here mostly because she's the author of a brand new book. It's titled Tree Thieves. You heard me, Tree Thieves, Crime and Survival in North America's Woods. I find Lindsay really interesting in that she seems to be writing at that challenging and crucial intersection between science and natural history and environmentalism and human societies and economics and cultural perspectives. And Lindsay will be the guest speaker at the Jefferson Land Trust in person, hopefully, fingers crossed, Land Fest on July 7th at Finn River Cidery. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but welcome, welcome, Lindsay.
Thank you so much. What a lovely introduction.
Yeah, and of course, for listeners, we are recording this via Zoom. Lindsay is deep in the interior of British Columbia. I'm nestled at home in Port Townsend, and if you hear strange noises in the background, it's because the neighbor is using a chainsaw. And Nora Petrich, our wonderful sound engineer and editor, is working out of the KPTZ studio. So before we get into the conversation with Lindsay, let's hear this week's mystery sound. So I will give you a little hint. It's a little bird. And it's constantly dancing and dashing and sort of flittering among the low shrubs and thickets. They grab insects off of a leaf. And if you see the male, it is easily identifiable. And I was so happy that I actually saw one in my yard about a week ago. So we'll come back to that towards the end of the program. But let's now dive into tree thieves. There's a little blurb on Lindsay's website that describes the book as featuring excellent investigative reporting, fascinating characters, logging history, political analysis, and cutting-edge tree science. Tree Thieves takes readers on a thrilling journey into the intrigue, crime, and incredible complexity sheltered under the forest canopy. Well, now, Lindsay, I must admit, I had not given much thought to tree thievery or poaching or, you know, even illegal logging until I encountered your book. What brought you to the subject and what was it about the subject that just sort of inspired you to write about it?
Well, in 2012, there was a news story that came out in Canada that an 800-year-old cedar that was in a park called the Carmana Walbrin on Vancouver Island had been poached.
Oh, and I remember that story.
Yeah. Yes, it is the kind of, well, it was the tipping point for me. So I read this news story. At the time, I was a freelance journalist, and I thought, oh, this is a very interesting story. I think it could maybe make a good magazine story. So I started calling and doing interviews with BC Parks Rangers in particular. And once I started digging into it, I realized that it was a lot more than simply a story about a crime. And so that's what really got me interested in writing a book about it. And that's really what kind of set me on fire to be very interested in this for about a decade now. So yeah.
Decade, yes.
It has been. So, you know, at the time, I actually don't know if I could have recognized this, but I'm very motivated and interested in environmental history. And poaching is a really deep part of that history. And it's a very interesting part of that history. And so that was what really kind of understanding the roots of poaching and it's common, you know, how common it was in history and until today, that's really what got me going on this subject.
That's sort of curious. I kind of think about, you know, poaching rabbits from British estates or Robin Hood stories. I'm surprised because I really don't think much about it as a current activity. And part of your book was like, whoa, what? Yes, it is. So give us a picture of how big an issue, and I don't know whether you want to call it tree theft or poaching or illegal logging or however you want to describe it. How big an issue is that in the Pacific Northwest?
Yeah, so it's interesting. It seems to be an issue that, you know, comes and goes a little bit. There are some years when it's very common. And so, for instance, in 2018, the end of 2018, the Forest Service actually put out a release saying that they had noticed a big uptick in poaching in the Pacific Northwest. So sometimes there are increases in reported theft sites found, and sometimes it dies off a bit, but it pretty much tends to always come back. So the Forest Service values the annual dollar figure worth of poaching to be $100 million every year from U.S. public lands. So it is a big problem. It comes in all sorts of shapes and sizes. So that could be one tree taken down in a park. It could be burl poaching, which I get into in the book as well, redwood burl poaching. It could be smaller cut sites where multiple trees have been taken down over a period of time. It could be poaching off of private logging land that was due to be logged anyway, but is, you know, someone might be taking some on the sly. So it looks and takes all different forms, but it is much more common than you might think. In 2020, during the first kind of round of COVID, you know, summer 2020, spring, summer 2020, there was so much poaching happening on Vancouver Island that a forest manager called it its own epidemic, which was very interesting. Mm-hmm.
Was that same pattern observed in the U.S.?
I never heard directly about that, but I did notice through following like news reports and stuff that it certainly continued during that time.
Mm-hmm. I'm sort of assuming there's probably no fundamental differences between tree poaching in British Columbia and in Washington State, that it's probably pretty similar.
I think it looks similar. I think the motivation is the same. I think the differences are on a kind of bureaucratic level. So we in Canada have different agencies. We don't have the Forest Service. We have Crown lands that are managed by our province, and we have national parks, which are managed federally. So there are different management structures around our forests, but it's still theft from land that is public and land that is often meant to be preserved for conservation.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a bit about sort of the impacts on forest ecology that these kinds of activities have. And I'm sure it's more than just removing a tree or two here or there. So talk to me about that.
It's interesting because the final third of the book, it takes into account my time as a National Geographic explorer when I went to Peru and I was talking about illegal logging in South America, in the Amazon region. And that's happening on an incredibly massive scale that is no longer happening in North America. So up here, you know, it can look a little bit like, well, one or two trees taken from the edge of a property every year, you know, it's not the same as clear cut land in a forest. But a lot of the forests that we have in North America, on the Pacific West Coast in particular, are the last remaining old growth mm-hmm. on our continent. And old growth, you know, and I would imagine that your listeners might know this, it has its own benefits. It has it's very important to the ecology of a region. It's very important. They are very important to overall forest health. So old growth brings benefits to the forest that new growth, relatively new growth or second growth, just can't bring. Mm-hmm. And part of that is providing a habitat for endangered species. So we know from the history of, for instance, the timber wars of, mm-hmm. you know, the kind of late 20th century, that the spotted owl, the northern spotted owl, the marbled murrelet, they rely on old growth. They will not seek shelter in new growth. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that that old growth stands is key to their survival. So the trees themselves provide really important habitats for flora and fauna. They also contribute to overall forest health in a way that new growth can't, because their root systems are complex and aged, and they support the ground underneath us in ways that new growth can't mm-hmm. yet and doesn't yet. And they also are a provider of new growth as well. So a lot of old growth have the capacity to sprout new growth mm-hmm. off of them. So there's a kind of lineage involved in that.
So let me ask you kind of another question. When we think about commercial logging and the impacts of it, a lot of the impacts are due to road construction, soil compaction, changes mm-hmm. in stream flow, stream temperature. Does poaching have some of those same issues?
I think particular cases definitely do. So there are individual cases where, for instance, a poacher might transport a log in a truck and drive that truck into perhaps a little bit into the forest itself. And if the truck has a leak, then you've got smaller mm-hmm. instances of pollution in that way. So there is a destabilization on a smaller scale. In my book, I talk about the maple fire case in Washington, and that I think is a kind of primary example of how poaching can lead to much greater damage. And this was a case of poaching that led to a massive forest fire. Okay, so that was a case where a group of poachers had identified a large old growth maple in Olympic National Forest. They had decided to poach this tree. They went to it. It turned out that there was a wasp nest in the tree. And in a bid to rid the tree of the wasp nest, they used fire, and that fire spread into a massive forest fire that required much state resources to put out.
That's interesting. I had not heard that story before.
Yeah.
You know, the Olympic Peninsula is our backyard here. I am remembering the really bad fire summers of 18 or 19, and mm-hmm. that there were fires on the western part of the Olympics.
Yes, and actually, as our climate continues to change, and as the forests that were once just like so humid and waterlogged, and you know, you would never think that this place could start on fire, basically, yeah. as that changes and fires on the Olympic Peninsula are increasing, there is a greater risk because the tools that are used in tree poaching can spark and create flame.
So your book has a lot of just really solid science and a lot of recent information on what we're learning about through the biology and ecology of trees and forest ecosystems. And I know there's a really deep store of information there, but I'm wondering if there might have been something that you found intriguing or surprising or eye-opening about some of that science. Could you share, you know, one or two examples of that?
Well, I think that what I would find most intriguing, of course, is the things that we actually don't know. So there's just a lot that we're still learning about forests and about old growth and about trees that that continues to shift as well over time. And so there's just so much room for developments in that. And I really kind of was drawn to that part of the book through Burls. So I do spend a lot of the book discussing burl poaching, particularly in Northern California.
And so those are big, massive growths you see on the redwood trees.
Exactly. Big, yeah. Gnarly kind of, they look like big bellies sometimes if they're at, right. You know, and you depending on where.
Cut in slices to be tables and the
yep,
like.
Exactly. Yep. And so burl poaching from redwoods in Redwood National and State Park is common. And there's been some studies done on how often it happens. And anyway, there is some debate around how damaging it can be for a burl to be poached. And I'm really kind of interested in that question because there is science that shows that a burl, for instance, so a burl is created when the tree has undergone a bit of distress. And it's created as a kind of healing spot after maybe a lightning strike or even drought. Mm-hmm. And it holds the kind of genetic data of that tree so that if a fire or if it gets damaged again, a new tree can sprout from that burl.
That's cool.
That is very cool. I would say that it's also a relatively small part of a tree that is just absolutely massive. You know, redwoods are huge. And there is disagreement between what we know about a burl and what burl poachers see the worth of a burl is. And so some burl poachers, you know, had said to me, like, if I remove a burl, it is not hurting the tree. It's not going to fall down. It's not going to die, all of this. And there was a disconnect there. And part of it too is that to truly understand the damage that removing a burl can do, we would need to start doing that science now and hope that 300 years from now, there's a researcher still looking into this. So it's very, there is room for a bit of confusion, misinformation, whatever you want to,
yeah,
you know, or even to be honest, like kind of a folk knowledge versus a more scientific approach. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was very interesting. There's certainly a disagreement on that level of how really how damaging taking the burl could be.
Mm-hmm. But it's interesting just biologically to think about it as the repository of the genetic information for new growth.
So for instance, I visited a burl poaching site and it was, you know, there was the body of the tree, the burl had been cut off, but there were new sprouts coming out from there already.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, your book really weaves together a lot of biology, ecology, forest history, forest tree history, and a lot of sociocultural themes because it is a pretty complex issue. And your book does a really nice job saying this is not a good guy, bad guy situation. This is pretty complex.
Yeah, thank you.
And we really don't have, of course, the time to kind of deeply understand that.
Yeah.
But based on your understanding and your research, what do you think the biggest mistakes have been sort of both in the U.S. and in Canada in forest management? And if you could change things for the future, what would you do?
I think first I can answer that in the context of this book, because I think there are many people that can point out many.
Well, that's true.
You know, like, I mean, I think that, for instance, there have been what we know about fire management now versus what we knew about 100, you know, all of that.
Within the context of the book.
Within the context of this book. When I was doing my interviews with the poachers who appear in the book, and those poachers were just so generous and honest and open with me, and I really appreciated it. They kind of continually said, you know, it's not that we disagree that these trees aren't valuable or what have you, but there was this real through line of resentment towards how conservation areas had come to be instated, how work had been transitioned from logging into whatever was going to come next for really generations of logging families, and how that may lead to now kind of 50 years later, someone in that lineage, because the poachers really were kind of grandsons and mm-hmm. sons of former loggers and mill workers, mm-hmm. to feel that, you know, this is a way that I know how to earn money.
Yeah.
And this is, in some cases, there was a sentiment of, this is something that was taken away from me. Mm. And I'm really resentful towards that. And it's all wrapped up in some anger there. And so I think that, you know, that has happened in history. I think understanding how perhaps our approaches to conservation in the past may not have trickled down in the way that we wanted them to, into an acceptance that we wanted them to, can lead us to undertaking what needs to be done today in a kind of more inclusive and understanding way. And I think part of that, and you know, at the end of the book, I discussed this. And then also, it's actually something I really hope to talk to people about at the Jefferson Land Trust gala, when I'm doing the Land Fest gala, when I'm speaking there. And that's kind of the power of community forestry and, mm-hmm. and understanding forestry beyond logging, and maybe considering it as something that has all these facets that relate to people and who they are in their community and how their environment affects who they are and how their community affects the environment, and how seeing all the gray zones there might actually be a more stable and inclusive and effective form of conservation.
Mm-hmm. That will be an important thing to talk about. And mm-hmm. I think listeners may know that there's quite a bit of interest in developing a community forest down on Chimicum Ridge, but we're going to save that for another conversation. For those of you who may have just joined, I've been talking with Lindsay Borgon. Lindsay is the author of a book called Tree Thieves. It will be released this June 21st. It's available through her website. It's also available right here in town at the Imprint Bookstore on Water Street, Port Townsend. And plus, I'm sure it's available on the usual online sources. And as Lindsay mentioned, she will be the featured speaker at Jefferson Land Trust's Gala Land Fest. That's July 7th at Finn River. If it all goes well, it'll be live for the first time in 2 years. And Lindsay, in addition to offering the keynote talk, will be available to sign copies of her book. And I would encourage any listener, if you're interested, you can find out a lot more information on the Jefferson Land Trust website, which is saveland.org. And Lindsay, thank you again so very much.
Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed this.
Well, and we're going to wrap up with that mystery sound again. Let's hear it. So that was a Wilson's warbler. It's one of our smallest warblers. They're a wonderfully bright, bright yellow, and they're kind of maybe towards the olive side as well, but they have big black eyes that stand out on their yellow cheek. And then the males are amazing. They have this wonderfully dark, distinctive black cap. I also have learned that Western populations tend to be brighter yellow than Eastern populations. They're found all over this country, and they spend winters in Mexico and Central America. But I found this little tidbit interesting. When they migrate north to breed, whether it's Alaska, Canada, or the Pacific Northwest, they actually travel through all of the lower 48 states. I urge you to look for them. And that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news. Today's sound engineer and editor is Nora Petrich. Recent podcasts are available on the KPTZ website, that kptz.org. Thanks so much for listening. And our closing music is I Talk to the Trees, sung with Latin rhythms by Justin Gregory Lopez. And it's from Seattle's Fifth Avenue Theater's 2016 production of the classic Lerner and Lowe musical, Paint Your Wagon.
I talk to the trees, but they don't listen to me. I talk to the stars, but they never hear me. The breeze hasn't time to stop and hear what I say. I talk to them all in vain. But suddenly my words reach someone else's ears, touch someone else's heart strings too. I tell you my dreams, and while you're listening to me, I suddenly see them come true. Can you see a sun in April night, sipping brandy underneath the stars, reading poems in the candlelight to the strumming of guitars? I would tell you all the books I've read, and the way I met the King of France. Then we'll send the servants off to bed,
and you'll ask me for a dance.
Dungeness River Nature Center is pleased to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature, Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.